often said that there's a Roxy Music song for every situation. Situation. Now, there is a word, the passing parade of moments that make up that ultimate passing fancy, life. I'm Jonathan Green. This is Blueprint for Living. It's the last half hour. And this week, a transient combination of music, food trends, breakout pods, architectural pavilions, and pop-up community gardens. Our topic, for now, impermanence. Our cities are full of temporariness. Fleeting spaces quickly filled, pop-up shops, dossing downs, farmers markets, city beaches, roaming food trucks. Ali Madanipour is Professor of Urban Design at Newcastle University in the UK, author of Cities in Time, Temporary Urbanism and the Future of the City.
There is a number of different trends that come together in this temporary use of space. Digitization, casualization of work, and also the big economic crash, the global economic crash of 2007-08 that paves the way for intensification of all this. On the one hand, it opens the door for people to work on their own, to use spaces, the time they want. And on the other hand, it makes the urban processes much more open to various interests. So depending on which type of person you are, what type of interest you have, these processes can be progressive or regressive. If you are a young person full of energy and interest and you want to get out and plant some community gardens, of course it's progressive, it's a good thing to do. But if you think about it in the context of public parks no longer being funded by local authorities and the austerity measures in public policy, which reduces the publicness of the park and transfers the control and management of them to groups outside the public sector, that combination together, you see how it can be both. And in the long run, it can make conditions precarious for many public services, public spaces, which become dominant by small interests. The whole idea of young creative types having to rely on these opportune moments rather than being given the possibility of developing their careers, it shows casualization and some sort of vulnerability, which then gets normalized and becomes everyday acceptance.
That thing of normalization is an interesting one. I mean, does that suggest about our moment that there's a sort of sense of interim about it, that we are becoming something, that there's a temporariness about things which may or may not resolve in some other more permanent form?
It looks like we are at a moment that this thing is expanding. You see, people talk about gig economy and how it's going to be 30 to 40% of the workforce on that basis, which is a labor market version of temporary use of space. And that is a point in time that we are. Whether it's going to be like that for a long time, I don't know. But you see how, for example, Airbnb is expanding, or container architecture is expanding. Part of it is also something turns into a fashion trend. Something comes out of a necessity. I don't know, ripped jeans that may have been at some point an expression of poverty, but then it becomes an expression of cool, and millionaires wear it and pay a lot of money to buy one. So that is a transition from necessity to a cultural expression. So in that sense, it is detached from the conditions that produced it.
Free-floating fragments of culture are not just the preserve of urban street life. The culinary world is rife with them. Black garlic is one of the more recent. Nikki Reimer is head chef at Bellotta.
So imagine it's around 2008. There's a farmer. He has too much garlic. He has thousands of kilos of it. And he does some research as to what can he do with this garlic. And he sees that there's been some Korean and Japanese and Chinese history of fermenting garlic to get it that lovely black colour. So he gets on board with this, makes all this black garlic, and he sells it. In some places you can buy it for like $150 a kilo. And it came out as this trend. You must use black garlic. It will be the best addition to your dish. It's soft, it's gooey, and it tastes like balsamic vinegar. And it does have some health properties. It is a good thing. But it kind of got overused. Next minute we had black garlic aioli on every side dish. And I'm not all that keen on dipping my chips into black goo, I'll be honest. And it kind of got overused with desserts. We saw black donuts, like chocolate and black garlic, and let's make this savory donut. And I just think it was one of those trends in food that kind of took an interesting ingredient and went a little bit too far. We decided that we can make a dessert with this. It's like, let's keep it for what it is. Nice, thinly sliced, or add it to some lamb and some beef, and you've got something interesting. But when you start to take something that you make really interesting and then you just pack it into every recipe and menu and design you can do with food, kind of loses its interest. And now I think you struggle to see it as much, but you certainly do see people selling it. Certainly in the country Victoria, I've seen it around country New South Wales, where people are growing a lot of garlic. They will do their own fermentation. You can even do it like a Maillard reaction where you almost caramelise the garlic. But, you know, I'm not too sure on that black garlic aioli.
The trend towards the temporary is affecting our built environment as well. That which we think of as solid, permanent, and concrete is increasingly mobile. But despite what curators might have us believe, pop-up architecture is anything but new. John MacArthur is professor in the School of Architecture at the University of Queensland.
There's a very long and honourable history of architecture exploring its own content through buildings that are temporary or easy to construct and so on. The research project I'm involved in looks at very high art architectural pavilions of the kind typically commissioned by art galleries. And that word pavilion is taken off in architectural practice as a whole mode of practice. But the word itself goes a long way back. It comes from papilo, the Latin word for butterfly, which was used for tents in medieval times. And you can trace it back to, you know, the grand campaign tents of medieval kings, or to through 18th century garden structures, the sort of famous sort of Follies and Fabrique.
Does this in some way free architecture from what used to be the necessary preconditions for a building? I mean, if we have a pavilion which is part of an artistic project, it can just occur. There doesn't need to be a need for that thing as a residence, as a business, as all the other things that buildings need to be.
Yes, it can be a proposition or a representation. So it can stand for ideas or possibilities. In architectural history, the very famous ones are Le Corbusier's Pavillon d'Esprit Nouveau for the 1925 exposition in Paris was like one of the preeminent ideas about multiple housing, what social housing would be in the modern era. And that was built as the pavilion of his magazine, Esprit Nouveau. And it's a proposition for a way of life and a way of making buildings that's made out of ticky-tacky and lasted a few months. Whether or not it didn't function to house anyone, whether that particular design would have functioned well to house someone is not really the point. The point is to cast out this idea and be a provocation for a whole kind of architecture and a whole vision about how architecture ought to engage with the world.
But there's a lot of pop-up, a lot of architectural temporariness, which is pretty much sub Corbusier.
Yes, there is. There's an awful lot of this stuff happening at the moment. In our research, we tried to find some sort of way of quantifying this, and we did a kind of search of the blog sphere, and we estimated that of these very sort of high art architectural pavilions, there were 45 exhibited in the world in 2010, and in 2015 there were 170. And I think that exponential moment is continuing, so I'd say the number today is huge, and there are whole numerous programs for this, awards for pop-up buildings and so on. So it is a phenomenon in and of itself. And it's kind of interesting that there's very little interest or recognition of that longer history I talked about, and I'm not even sure that there should be. But Hans-Ulrich Obrist, very prominent curator, and current director of the Serpentine Galleries, he states quite boldly that Julia Payton Jones invented the pavilion in the year 2000 by commissioning Zaha Hadid to build a temporary pavilion at the Serpentine Galleries in London. Now, Obrist would know the history I just gave you, so he's not ignorant of these things. He's making a statement about its relevance being in contemporary culture rather than in this sort of architectural history.
And if you want to find the Sub Corbusier of the food world, that strange hollow reproduction of the real thing, well, it doesn't get any subber than Liquid Smoke. Nikki Reamer.
I love a barbecue. I love the flavour of barbecue. I love grilled pork. I love smoky sausages, grilled vegetables, all that kind of smoky flavour. But it does take time. But then someone decided, why don't we cut out that time factor and create Liquid Smoke? Now, this is something, I'm sorry to my American friends, but this is your fault. And this was a fad thing that came out that it was, I think it was the 60s. And, you know, a lot of cooking at that time was all about, we've got to do things in a rush. We have to have everything quickly. You know, we're sick and tired of the 50s and how slow everything took to cook. But now, you know, we're going to do it fast. So we bottle our smoke and then we can paint it on our food. And I think it's one of those, again, it's a kind of a condiment, but went horribly, horribly wrong. And to me, you know, scientifically proven to contain carcinogenic items in it. So I'm not quite sure why they thought it was a good idea to put into this bottle so that then you could spread onto your food. But it became very popular. And you can still buy it today. And people would buy jars of Liquid Smoke and paint it on their cooked chicken or paint it onto their cooked pork. It even got added into restaurant life and you would see it into dressings. So smoky lettuce dressings. There were even things like smoked berry tart, but the berries were never smoked. The lettuce was never smoked. They would literally paint things on or add it to a dressing. So I guess it was one of those times, certainly as a chef, when I look at why trends begin and why did that one start? It was all about making things quick. But then to put something that's literally liquefied smoke into a bottle and then pour it onto something just goes against the grain of cooking. Take the time with the barbecue, light the coals, let it happen. That's the natural way.
Now, food trucks, street festivals, pop-up art and architecture might give the impression of texture, of vibrant urban life. But are these interventions in fact transforming public space into sites of private consumption? Ali Madanipour.
This festivalization of public space goes back to Boston's Fenway Hall and places like that. They combine retail and festival atmosphere. So vibrancy feeds into footfall in retail terms. And that combination has worked well for a generation and continues. And it's a relatively cheap way to animate public space. If you look at business improvement districts that many, many cities have, this is a kind of collection of businesses and with the help of the local authority to stimulate and promote city centers often. They want to set up events and bring street vendors to animate the place, to make it looking vibrant and buzzing and attracting people who may come and do the shopping. At the same time, you see on the other side of this, that informality, that street vending, is a way of livelihood in many poor cities around the world. In some cities, the majority of population rely on that livelihood that is earned on the street.
Architecture has also been mobilised in the experience economy. Step into any architectural pavilion and you're offered a curated experience. John MacArthur.
Architecture's always been in the service of commerce and government. So I think some of the things that are changing rather are the relationship between culture and economy per se. One of the things is the way in which retail itself becomes a form of culture, that the, you know, the opening of a new Apple store or a Nike superstore or something like that is a kind of an event in culture as much as cinema or ballet once were, perhaps. So I think there is this kind of shift where the strong lines that were previously drawn between culture and the economy are shifting. And part of that's to do with economic measurements of the cultural economy. So by the time you can calculate, as we now do, the overall value of the cultural economy, which puts together, say, real activities like building buildings, which you can put dollar values to proxy values like visitor numbers to galleries and so on. We have this kind of perhaps flattening out, but also a sort of merging of boundaries where the kinds of events that once might have been seen as quite separate are sort of seen in the same sort of space. And because architecture's been in the past a high profile, you know, high culture form of art along with painting and sculpture, and the fact that it's necessarily commercial and has always been commercial and commissioned by large corporations, government, wealthy individuals, it becomes a kind of bridging point to think through some of these kinds of issues about what happens when we start to renegotiate the relationship between culture and the economy as a whole. And I think that there are lots of problems in thinking in that way.
And within the practice of architecture, I mean, how liberating is the notion of the pop-up architecture? I mean, how unbinding is that? How enabling of experimentation and autonomy?
Well, very much so, because it's become a mode of practice in itself, so that they're very similar ways of thinking, techniques, building practices that run across the whole spectrum between the kind of high art cultural commissions through to the sort of pop-up retail. So there are firms now who, you know, specialise in festival architecture, pop-up retail, and indeed, you know, cultural works, art commissions. So it makes a very sensible mode of practice for certain kinds of architectural practices. The degree to which it allows greater architectural experimentation is, I guess, the thing to consider. Certainly a lot of commentators are fairly negative about this phenomenon, thinking that it doesn't on the whole broach the large kind of questions that were once broached under modernism. The larger questions about, you know, what the cultural meaning of architecture should be or how technology should be developed. So many commentators are, I guess, suspicious of this, that it could become a trivialised mode of practice that doesn't ask the sort of harder questions. That's true. There are many of these things which are not interesting architecturally, just as many of them are interesting. What is, I think, a bigger concern is the scale of the phenomenon itself. I think the fact that we have this increasing pace of urban life, increasing seasonalisation of our behaviour through festivals and so on, is in itself significant. And the growth of this phenomenon of architectural pavilions that aren't closely tied to a particular function or closely tied to a development of a particular piece of land is an occasion, I think, for us to rethink what architecture might be and what role it might have in a much broader view of culture.
And just as in architecture, passing trends that may appear fleeting, insubstantial, ephemeral, nevertheless can and often do prompt us to rethink cultural practices. If nothing else, they can wake us from our slumber. Culinary history and evolution is forged in this cycle, and there's perhaps no better illustration of this than the story of Nouvelle Cuisine. Hirima.
I'm a chef, have been cooking now for almost 25 years, and I can still remember the first cookbooks I bought, and it was all about Nouvelle Cuisine, and this was the new kid on the block in the world of cuisine. We'd all learned how to make thick, heavy French sauces and ragouts of Italian food that was cooked forever, but I guess this really did start with French cooking, and it came out, I guess, to the forefront in the 60s. The Concorde on its first flight had Paul Bocuse doing the menu, and it was titled Nouvelle Cuisine because everyone had come out of this world of haute cuisine and classic cuisine where everything was very heavy and cooked for days and you must do it this technique, to use something fresh, do something smaller, think about health. You know, all of this thing came into the world of cooking. Consider local cuisine. Make the food taste like where it's from. Use those gorgeous little fish from the trout from the brooks and things like that. And it became an entire movement that changed the way we cook even now. I think people like Paul Bocuse were really one of those chefs that were at the forefront of it because he wanted to change things. He didn't want to cook the same old coq au vin every year. He wanted to make things new. And a lot of the guidebooks and the French food writers took that on board, and it became this trend that we still do now. And I think it's a wonderful thing because it's really changed the way we cook, the way we see food. Nouvelle Cuisine in the 80s got a bit of a bad rap. got considered, oh, it's a tiny piece of food on a massive plate. The plate is beautiful and the food is tiny. And I think there was a period there when it possibly got taken too far. The idea behind it got a little murky, and all of a sudden people decided that I could make lots of money out of it. But then it did come back to its truer roots, and I think nowadays you see it when it's talked about and written in cookbooks about how to cook like this, you are looking back at making your food more of a fresher style and using better ingredients. But there were the dark days of the 80s when, yeah, a tiny tomato on a plate is not nouvelle cuisine.
It'd be wrong to describe Samuel Barber as a one-hit wonder, an ephemeral flicker of fame, and yet in the popular imagination, and thanks in no small part to Oliver Stone's Platoon, that's what most of us know of Barber's work. Is this what we know of Tommaso Albinoni? It's perhaps entirely reasonable that this is all we know and all we need ever know of history's greatest wedding composer, Johann Pachelbel. And then, what about these? Can you name those ephemeral uni hits? That's music, a mysterious combination of impermanence and lasting, indelible impression. While impermanence may be a prerequisite for cultural evolution, something about today's impermanence feels different. Things seem more contingent, less stable. Rather than a productive, creative force, is impermanence today simply a symptom of precarity, a sign of crisis? Ali Madanipour.
In the same sense as pop art reflected a particular moment in culture and a particular type of culture, pop-up architecture and temporary use of places reflects a particular moment, a particular cultural situation. But at the same time, the subtext, the conditions of people who work and live in urban environments these days, when they say young people cannot afford to own their own home or they cannot rely on long-term employment, it shows a degree of uncertainty and precariousness in the economy, in the conditions of life, which step by step becomes normalized and casualization becomes accepted as a way of life. When you look at the situation in Latin American cities, in what were called slums, they were temporary structures. People just put them up to live in very precarious situations. But they became and have become acknowledged as the birth of new parts of the city. They've been formalized. They've been made more permanent. So in a sense, it's not only the case that temporary installations and structures are just a show of precarity. They can be stepping stones towards a new form emerging. And ultimately, if you look at the life of nomads, and it goes back to living in tents, the nomads may be happy to live nomadic lives, and they've adjusted to this rhythm. But ultimately, their lifestyle is because there was not enough food in one place, and they had to move. And that precarity, that vulnerability to the elements, is then woven into their lifestyle, and they take their tents and they move from here and there. And that may be the way a lot of now we have nomadic urbanism, that people constantly move in search of new jobs and new opportunities from here to there.
You've been listening to The Last Half Hour. This week, impermanence. You heard from Ali Madanipour, Professor of Urban Design at Newcastle University, author of Cities in Time, Temporary Urbanism and the Future of the City, John MacArthur, Professor in the School of Architecture at the University of Queensland, Nikki Reimer, Head Chef at Bellotta in Melbourne,
Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Melissa May. I'm Jonathan Green. I